I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidel. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Fair.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. You got us wired up perfectly once again to the World Wide Web, and we're broadcasting live and streaming audio throughout the world. And we do occasionally have someone on the other side of the world listening. Well, welcome to Blog Talk Radio, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Keith Haley, the host of the Jumble Justice radio show. We want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that trip to 90 cities and states across the United States. And Johnny, if you're listening up there, I think we finally got you some warm weather when you pass through Dayton, Ohio, and some of these spots here in Ohio. The sun was actually out, so you will probably appreciate that. Mike and Emily, thanks again for helping us tonight. You got us an overload of news stories, so much going on with criminal justice. Supreme Court in session right now, making some important kinds of decisions, and perhaps one or two of those cases we'll talk about tonight in our news segment. The purpose of our show, ladies and gentlemen, is what it always is, to discuss news issues, events, and developments in this fabulous field of criminal justice. What a place to spend a career or several careers. And we talk sometimes about some of the humorous aspects of this field also. We'll have one of those stories tonight. Our show is dedicated, ladies and gentlemen, to those tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. And our guest tonight is going to just personify what our show is really about, somebody who's leading an important criminal justice agency here in the state of Ohio, and has had influence not only here but across the nation. What we try to do is look inside the practice of criminal justice and look at its professionals and what they do. And we did accept the compliment. Somebody did say once that we're sort of the NPR of the criminal justice radio business, and we'll accept that. I don't know how many people we're competing with, but we will, in fact, accept that. We're doing this on Blog Talk Radio, and I like to mention every week that you can get your own show. It's all possible, and probably in 5 to 7 minutes you could be signed up and broadcasting in almost no time, and you can broadcast worldwide in streaming audio at no cost to an unlimited number of listeners. And those of you been around the Internet for 10 or 15 years or longer, as I've been, this is a major achievement, because when you tried this back in the mid-1990s or a little bit later even, you could listen, you could broadcast about 40 or 50 people, and that didn't always work. So this is fabulous. Any person in the interest group, it can be from cigars to darts to homicide investigation to CSI to watching polar bears, you can have your own show and broadcast as much as 14, 15 hours a week, and it's absolutely free. So it's sort of like that motto on the back of the slogan on the back of the Cheez-Its box that says, get your own box where you can get your own show. Tonight's show is going to be very interesting, and we're waiting for our guest to call in. But our guest tonight is going to be Sheriff Tim Rodenberg, who's sheriff of Claremont County in Ohio. And what a beautiful county he's sheriff of. It's down just east of Hamilton County, Cincinnati. It's on the Ohio River. Appalachian Highway runs right through the center of that county. It's rolling, beautiful forested hills. So what a place to be sheriff and to lead an organization, and he certainly has a fine one. I visited that organization once here in the not-too-distant past, and it's certainly a lovely place and a lovely facility and an inspired group of people that work with him. So we're looking forward to speaking with him tonight. What you can do as a listener, of course, is you can listen on the Internet, as some of you probably are, or you can listen on your cell phone, and you can call in to 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983, and we can hold as many as five calls at a time, and all five of us can talk to each other. And occasionally that has actually happened when we've had multiple authors on and things like that. So it's 347-996-5983, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from you if you'd like to do that. Now, folks, folks probably know that, you know, we have Audrey England, who introduces our show. She is our technical and spiritual advisor to the show. I'm looking at the switchboard here. Audrey, what's going on with that thing? We blanked out on no caller. I don't know if we have a caller on number one or one. I don't know if we do. Let's try something here and see what. Nope. Okay. Anybody on that line?
I'm here, Keith.
Okay, you are. Okay, you've got a secret number. One of those secret CIA numbers that doesn't show up, right, Sheriff?
Well, yes, and I called before, and I don't think it connected. I think there was a technical difficulty somewhere on the line.
Well, that's a pretty rare event, actually, with Blog Talk Radio, but welcome to our show, Jumble Justice, and we really appreciate you taking some time out tonight in a very busy schedule, I know, and we're looking forward to it. And, you know, it's been a while since you've been on the show. I think you were here one other time before, and you know, Audrey, she wanted to say something to you, so I'm going to go ahead and let her Audrey, you put that coffee down and go ahead and say something to the sheriff there.
Sheriff Rodenberg, on behalf of the staff of the Jumble Justice Radio Show, I want to personally thank you for visiting with us again tonight. Your vast and varied experiences in criminal justice will be an educational delight for our listeners. I look forward to speaking with you later this evening. Take care.
Well, thank you, Audrey. I'm going to have to meet that lady someday, Keith. I've never met her in person, but I've talked to her.
Really eager to meet you, and I think sometimes when I go south down here, I will stop in. How's that?
Please do that. Thank you.
I don't know if you recall, but Audrey England, she is from Great Britain, from London, actually. And Audrey's been a collector of Bond jokes, Sheriff, since she was a child. She actually has drawers full of them, tucked underneath her bed and in trunks and all sorts of things. And so each week we play a blonde joke, and, you know, keep in mind, Audrey is a blonde, and she loves these jokes, and our audience seems to like them. So go ahead and play one tonight, if you don't mind. Audrey, go ahead.
Professor Haley, tonight we are going to break precedent. Instead of having one blonde joke, we are going to have three shorter ones. I picked one. Emily selected another. Mike selected the third one. Here they are. We hope our listeners enjoy them. Question: if a blonde and a brunette fell off a building, who would hit the ground first? Answer: the brunette. The blonde would have to stop for directions. Joke number two. The assistant asked the blonde if she would like her pizza cut into 6 pieces or 12. 6, please, she said. I could never eat 12. And finally, joke number three. A blonde was walking down the road with a healthy-looking pig under her arm. As she passed the bus stop, someone asked, "Where did you get that?" The pig replied, "I won her in a raffle."
Well, I don't know how many of you. And
you probably just... Go ahead, Jeff. you probably just lost all your blonde listeners, but
no.
That was good.
I like
that.
And my wife's a blonde. She loves the jokes.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it's okay. They were all in fun.
One of the things we try to do, Tim, in the interest, and I know you support this mission, is we try to do everything we can do on this show, our very small part, to help reduce street and country road crime here in the United States. So we play the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. We like to play their public service announcement each week. And this, I think, is directed, I believe it is directed toward the, you know, the street thugs and muggers and armed robbers and carjackers. And the idea is to get them to lay down their guns. So we're going to go ahead and play that, if you don't mind.
Oh, go right ahead.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Coalition, and we appreciate what you're trying to do is get the guns out of the hands of those criminals. I think that's what that means, but I'm almost afraid to pursue it any farther. But, Tim, would you mind if we did a couple news stories tonight, and you can comment on with us, and then we'll get right into the business of I put the lead on our show billing tonight. I said it's winning and leading the office of sheriff, and different than a lot of different or kinds of jobs and executive positions in criminal justice, you got to win this one, don't you?
Absolutely, yes. We're the only elected chief executive law enforcement officer in the country, if not the world, sheriff's office. Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, here's a story out of Dallas. Just came out yesterday. It's kind of a odd thing. A tow truck driver tows away a car and has got a 7-year-old boy sleeping in the back. And
oh,
his parents see the car taken off, and when he gets out to check to make sure that, you know, how they sometimes take off, and then they'll stop and make sure that everything's okay. That's a good tow truck driver, right?
Right, yeah.
Out the car, he sees the boy sleeping, so he hurriedly takes the car back and unhooks it, and he takes off down the street. And the mother, who was upstairs on a second-floor apartment, she runs down the street, and she sees all this happening. So she reports him to the police, and just literally minutes later, he gets stopped, and the police are charging him right now with child endangerment charges, but they said they're going to drop the charge. He said he was completely innocent. But the amazing thing about this boy never woke up. Can you believe
that?
Oh,
boy. Well, yeah, we've had some strange ones like that, too. It is amazing.
The tow truck driving business is, I imagine there are a lot of stories in that business, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got some characters out here, and they do a good job for us for the most part, but there are some characters.
You know, this is a story that is very close to where the area that you're working in, but Great Britain's worried about their outside of London, out in the boondocks, so to speak. They're worried about the litter. And so what they're starting to do now is they're going to use their very sophisticated surveillance camera system instead of working just on criminals, they're also going to work on litterers. And, you know, in the city there, they've got some of those cameras set up where they'll actually talk to people. You know, they'll see people, they're actually programmed so that they read somebody, you know, is riding their bicycle in an area where you're not supposed to, you're supposed to dismount. It'll tell them to get off their bike and that type of thing. But I thought this was interesting. They're going to allow citizens to take cell phone pictures, videos of people littering, and then turn those into the cops. And then the cops are going to issue mail them citations.
Well, there's a few. I see a few problems with that. If you want to hear from me,
like what?
Well, first of all, when people litter, it's a quick movement. Usually, the bag goes out the window and it's on the road. Usually, you don't catch them in the act. Unfortunately, I've been the sheriff now over almost 12 years, and I go down the road and I see a lot of things laying there, but I've never yet once found someone throwing something out. I'm hoping to find my first one, but this doesn't happen that way. So I don't know practically or technologically by the time they would get their cell phone and take the picture if they would actually see the litter coming from a person's hand or vehicle.
All right. I think you'd probably set somebody up too, couldn't you? Throw something up against their car and then take a picture of it.
Well, you could. That could happen as well. And I'll be honest with you, Keith, we have a horrible littering problem here in Claremont County in the tri-state area near Cincinnati. Sometimes I think we're inhabited by hogs more than human beings. But I don't know what the answer is. There's so many other law enforcement priorities that are obviously more serious than littering. There's got to be an answer to it, but I'm not sure if more law enforcement is the answer.
Right. You know, that's right. It's an education process, probably. You and I were talking here recently about the tough littering laws in Texas. You see those signs all over Texas, don't mess with Texas. And I used to do my long runs on Sunday afternoon. I'd go by this one of those littering signs that said, don't mess with Texas, and then the fine print says, you know, here's the state law ordinance that you're violating and all that business, and lists the fine and all that. The one that I would run by would have bullet holes, probably about 12, 15 bullet holes in it. Then somebody dumped an old refrigerator right next to it.
Well, there you go. And, you know, it's a matter of civic pride, really, Keith. And I think what happened is when I first became sheriff, the first year or two I was in office, we had inmates out along the roadways and interstates picking up trash. And oddly, what happened is as soon as they were done within the next few days, there seemed to be even more trash there than before they started picking up. And what we sort of concluded was motorists would come by, see the inmates picking up trash, and deduce that, well, if I throw it out, someone will pick it up. And actually, it made the problem worse instead of better, but it did not resolve the problem at all because, like I say, within a few days or a week, the same amount of litter, if not more, was in the area that had just been picked up.
It's amazing the amount that is along the roads, isn't it? You know, in the states that are relatively flat and have high winds, North Texas and Oklahoma, you know, you can clean up something and literally 3 months later the wind's blown something in from who knows how far off. So, interesting problem. You know, the Supreme Court decided you can use lethal injection this week. Did you see that?
I did. I saw that this week, yes.
A lot of people think that that'll cause just another flurry of, I guess, of the justices. It was a plurality of the justices, and they think that maybe this will cause other kinds of litigation. But in contrast to that, and I'll be quick about this, Japan is going to broadcast an execution. I don't know if you saw that story. They found an execution recording of an inmate that was executed years ago, 1955. It's about an hour. And they talked to him and the religious service and all that. And guess when you find out your execution day in Japan?
Well, probably not years at a time like here, but when would it be?
The day that you're going to be executed. And this guy was told that he was going to be executed, and then literally hours later they hung him. And keeping in pace with that, Japan, that's the only major industrial country other than the U.S. to use the death penalty, they informed the death row inmate that they'll be hanged on the day of the execution. And last week, they hung four convicted murderers.
Wow. Well, with our legal system the way it is and the way it drags on, and you really need to do something to fix the whole death penalty process, that would never probably happen, Keith, under our laws and Constitution and with all the attorneys and judges involved.
You know, we have people arguing about death penalty all the time. I heard a radio commentator talking about it today who knew almost zip about it. And one of the arguments, there's probably 14 arguments of pro and con on each side of it, something like that. But he was talking about, well, it's not a deterrent. And, of course, one of the answers to that is, how would we know? We don't do it.
Well, that's true, absolutely. And it certainly does deter the individual who's executed.
Right.
But in a general sense, it is hard to pinpoint, certainly.
We have a story in one of our books, Mark Stallow and I, on called Crime and Punishment in the Lone Star State, and it's about a guy that was called McDuff Was Free to Kill is the name of the article, and he got off death row three times in Texas, if you can believe that, and got out and killed somebody the third time.
Oh, boy. Well, that can happen, yes.
Well, before we get into some background and Sheriff and kind of telling your story, I thought I'd just ask you this one more thing. This is about Sheriff Arpaio. And the Phoenix mayor is asking the FBI to check up on the sheriff because the sheriff is using saturation patrols in highly populated Hispanic neighborhoods. And he's sent, I guess maybe he gets maybe 12 a day or something like that. And he says he's getting these through legal traffic stops. He says, we simply don't profile. We don't do that. And so they get a legal traffic stop, and they inquire about the, their status in terms of legal or illegal. And they're sending quite a few, putting them into custody, turn them over to ICE, and then ICE is deporting him now, finally. And he says these deputies are trained, and they go into these neighborhoods, and they know what to look for in terms of traffic, and they're finding people. But a little conflict there between the sheriff and the mayor. I imagine the sheriff is overall nationwide, at least, is probably a little more popular than Mayor Gordon.
He's certainly well known. He's made a big issue out of immigration because that's a serious problem for him down there that, at least in Ohio, we have not experienced to that extent, certainly thus far.
Right. Well, Sheriff, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about your career and your life and experiences and what you do in the office of sheriff. And I thought we might just start out, Tim, and just talking about, you know, what drew you into law enforcement and criminal justice to start with?
Well, Keith, it actually started when I was about 17, maybe 16 years old and in high school. I was getting ready to get out of high school. I wasn't real sure about what I wanted to do, but along came a friend of our family who was a police cadet in Cincinnati. My parents knew his parents real well, and we got together, and I got talking to him. And at that time, they had a pretty neat cadet program in Cincinnati. Unfortunately, with budget cutbacks and the way things are today, it's not the same anymore, if existent at all. But basically, it was a co-op program where you would go to UC for 3 years, and you would basically work 3 months full-time, and then you'd be off 3 months. You'd go to college for a quarter. You'd then go back and work 3 months on and off for 3 years, and at the end of the 3 years, you'd have an associate degree, and the whole thing was paid for. Your college was paid for, and not only that, when you were working, you received a salary. So I went into that, and that's how I got my start, but I took a detour, of course, along the way.
Well, you're an excellent example, but that program in Cincinnati started way back in the early 60s, didn't it? And
I think it was, yes.
The first in the nation I know that was co-op, which was a wonderful idea, because I think one of the things that some of these cadets told me, and you've told me, I believe, is by the time you finish that 3 years and you've worked around in the department and all those different sections, you got a pretty good idea what that whole place is about, right?
Well, absolutely, and the nice thing about the co-op was it was a nice mix of practical and educational and academic experience wrapped into one over 3 years. You didn't just have to sit in a desk or behind a desk in a classroom, for a solid period of time. You got a break from the classroom. You went to the real world, if you will, and learned about the job, and then after you'd done that a while, you went back to the classroom, and it flip-flopped like that for 3 years, and I think it was a very effective
Great.
And worthwhile learning experience.
And look at the leaders that produced in Cincinnati and, other places. It's a great idea. And, you know, they're hard up for cops now, and everybody's looking and paying bonuses and all that business. I think dollar for dollar investment, I think this cadet program was worth everything it was ever put into it. So I hope we see more of these around. Well, what jobs did you have after you left college then?
Well, after I was getting ready to finished the cadet program, Keith, after my third year, I probably would have been about 1970. The Vietnam War was still going on, and my best friend had got drafted and went over there, and I knew some other people in the conflict, and I, for some reason, I guess because of my parents in part, who were both Army officers during World War II, I really felt it was essential that I go into the military. It was just something I felt I had to do or should do as a young man who was, at least at that time, able-bodied, and I decided to go for it, and I went down and looked into all the services, but I was really attracted to the Marines, so what I did is I basically signed up for the Marine Officer Training Program, and I went to the Marine Corps, and I served 5 years on active duty, and at the end of it all, I had been a company commander, a captain, and was responsible for about 250 Marines, and then that sort of took me away, if you will, for law enforcement until I returned to it many, many years later. But that took me on my way, and when I got out, I returned to college, got my bachelor's degree, thinking I would go back to the Cincinnati Police Department, but at that time they weren't hiring. There was a hiring freeze, and so I went on to law school. I was advised by several of my friends, don't come back to the police department now. You might get hired only to get laid off. So I went to law school and got my law degree, and practiced law with my wife in a private law practice for about 5 years. And then an opportunity came up to go to Claremont County, which I did as an assistant prosecutor. And I did that for 10 years, and towards the end of that tenure, Sheriff Van Camp, the sheriff had been out here for about 25 years, roughly, here in Claremont County, decided not to run again, and I was situated, Keith, at the right time, the right place, and had a lot of luck on my side, and it's all about timing and opportunity and being ready to jump when you get the chance, and I was there, and everything lined up. The stars were in perfect alignment, and I ran against someone, it was in 1996, there were two of us running, and I won by a significant margin, and I've been sheriff ever since then, 12 years, roughly, and I haven't been opposed in the previous three elections, nor am I going to be opposed this year and this next election. I'm running in November. There are no candidates running against me.
Outstanding, and the prosecutor's office in that county probably was a wonderful experience and groundwork for that, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that was a springboard into this office because what happened as a prosecutor, of course, I met a lot of police officers, detectives. I helped them with search warrants. I went to some crime scenes. They got to know me, and we developed a mutual respect for each other. And then when it came time for the sheriff's office to be open with the retirement of Sheriff Van Camp, actually a local police chief here in town, or here in the county, if you will, who I had a great deal of respect for, actually suggested to me, Tim, why don't you go after the office of sheriff? You'd be a great sheriff. And that got me to thinking. I looked around. I found out I had a lot of other support, and here I am.
You know, that makes me think of a thesis that one of our friends wrote at the University of Cincinnati, Paul Ferreira, who was the head of the Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation here in the state of Ohio. And his master's thesis was to study career mobility of people after they graduated. And one of the things found out by studying all these different people, he looked at many, many leaders in the law enforcement field, and it's like it wasn't like they decided they wanted this particular job and went for it. They just did a really good job in the current job they had, and they were prepared, and then the opening came up, and just like you said, you jumped on it, and away they went.
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer in that, Keith, because there's a lot of timing and good luck involved, but you've got to be prepared because when the window of opportunity opens, you've got to be ready to dive through it because it may not be open very long, and once it closes that window, others may open, of course, but that window may never open again.
What, according to Ohio law now, and then we'll get into some specific things here, but what's the job of the sheriff according to Ohio law?
Well, a number of things. Preserve the public peace is one thing that's in the Ohio Revised Code. In Title 311 of the Ohio Revised Code, there's a number of duties enumerated under that section and subsections. Obviously, serve the courts. That's another one, and that involves serving papers, protecting the courts, of course. We provide court security, prisoner transport to and from court, and then the third probably major responsibility under Ohio law is maintain and operate the county jail. So it's basically a full-service law enforcement type of agency here in Ohio, as opposed to some states where they only maybe have court service or civil process. We do it all.
Right. And it's only executive position where you're responsible across the whole system, isn't it? I mean, courts and corrections, right? Law enforcement, courts and corrections.
Yes, absolutely. We have all three, and we're the only law enforcement agency in Ohio's counties that have all three of those. There aren't any local jails to speak of anymore as far as city jails. They've all gone to county or regional jails, and so far as serving the courts, the only law enforcement agency that does that in Ohio is sheriffs. And, of course, most people, when they think of police work, that's patrol officers and detectives, and we do that as well. So we actually wear three different hats, if not more, at various times.
Does your jail take prisoners from other counties?
No, Keith, we looked into that, and we decided it wasn't going to be a good idea. First of all, our jail isn't big enough to hold the prisoners or the defendants we have here locally. We have to turn some away. To believe it or not, until recently, we had over 500 people on what we would call a turnaway or waiting list, people that were actually sentenced by courts to jail time, but because there was no room at the end, so to speak, it was full, we had to send them home and put them on a waiting list, and that waiting list at times is 2 and 3 years old, and that is not uncommon. That occurs everywhere. It's not just here in Claremont County. I would say probably in three-fourths of the jurisdiction in this country that's happening. Too little jail space for the number of defendants that are being sentenced by the court. So we decided, how could we take in realistically prisoners from other counties or other jurisdictions if we didn't have room to house our own? There was also a demographic issue involved. You know, we're a rural county here, not really rural, but we're right next to Cincinnati. The demographic makeup here is about 98%, give or take, Caucasian. And there are no minorities in the county, and some of the counties wanting to send their prisoners out here were from areas that had minorities. And that's it's not a racial or a racist thing, but when you put people confined in a given setting, you have to be careful with the mix you put in there, because it's like throwing, it could be like throwing gasoline on a fire. And we determined that it would not be very conducive to the, if you will, stability and good order of the institution to not only these guys are facing a, if you will, a traumatic experience being confined in and of itself, but then forcing various, if you will, demographic and racial backgrounds and groups upon each other. And we determined it could very well become a powder keg, which we already have, but it would make that even worse, and there's no telling where that might take us. So given everything considered, we have not done that. Other counties, however, have, but it hasn't worked out everywhere, and I'll be honest with you, it is very, very expensive proposition. We sent some prisoners to another county once, and it cost us a small fortune just for 10 or 20 beds, and it didn't even put a dent in the problem. So I'm not so sure about that unless you have just a lot of space sitting around, and we don't have that.
I'll bet these people are thrilled to get their reservation notice after about 2 years being out waiting, right?
Well, that's a very, very unsatisfactory operation, Keith. What happens is, say it's like a kid that steals a cookie out of the cookie jar today, and you're a parent, and you wait for 6 months or a year to smack them on the hand. What we have happening is these people commit a crime. They don't get into any more trouble, but they're sentenced to jail, and they go out in the community. They get back on their feet, many of them. They get a job. They get their families going, and all of a sudden, 6 months, a year, two, and even up to 3 years down the road, you're getting a phone call from our jail saying, okay, your number's up. We have room for you. Now it's time to report in to serve your 10 or 20 days. And it's usually not for a serious crime either, I might add, in the larger scheme of things. It's perhaps a major driving violation, a no driver's license or suspended license, maybe a bad check or a shoplifting. So it's not, these are not violent offenders that are put on the list. We always find room for them. It's people who have committed more of what you might call a minor or petty or a nuisance type of crime, and now we're going to pluck them out of their life situation, put them in jail for 10 days, they'll lose their job, and it might just drive them back into a life of crime, whereas they weren't involved in that in the first place because they had been living crime-free for the years they were waiting to come back to our jail.
Yeah, that's tough. That is, that's a problem. Boy, we... you know, I was thinking some of the these other counties that do regionalize, they're places that don't have enough people to put in their own jail, right? So they
that's correct, and it's a financial thing too, Keith. Our jail operation is probably all between $5 and $6 million a year. It's very, very expensive to house inmates. There have been estimates I know for prisons that it might cost up to $50,000 a year per inmate in some prisons. We probably don't spend that much, but in order to build a jail to house all the inmates you might have or might expect you'll have, some counties, given the way budgets and resources are today, it's simply not workable to build a big enough facility. And so what they do sometimes, some counties do, we haven't done it down here yet, but the smaller counties with less resources pool their resources and they build regional jails to cover maybe 2, 3, or even 4 counties.
Well, how is the office sort of set up? How are you organized? What are your parts?
Well, basically, what I've got, Keith, is of course myself at the top, and I report directly to the voters. Some people might not know this, but I don't really have a boss per se, other than the people who elect me. There are no commissioners or trustees that oversee me. I'm on my own, basically, and I get my report card every 4 years when I face the voters, and quite frankly, nothing in between of any significance other than, you know, if people call in telling us we did a good job or they have complaints, of course, we address those. But what I have underneath myself is two chief deputies. One is on the criminal operations side, and that's the nuts and bolts of law enforcement, road patrol, investigations, narcotics, the SWAT team, our underwater search and rescue team, motorcycle patrol, et cetera. And on the other side is the chief deputy in charge of jail and court operations, and he is in charge of the jail, of the entire jail, which holds about 330 inmates currently here in our county, all the court security, the metal detectors at the door, transport of the prisoners, civil unit, which serves all the papers, subpoenas, eviction notices, and other things. So we have that broken down that way, and underneath them, total, we have about 225 employees in the Claremont County Sheriff's Office, probably half and half, half under the criminal operations and half under the jail hyphen court operations component.
I bet that somebody that's been sheriff, and then this probably happened more than once, somebody's been sheriff and ends up going into police work, they feel like they're going into retirement as police chief, right?
Well, that could be. Yeah, that could be. I'll be honest with you, Keith. I tell people all the time, I'm a firm believer, if your office does something good and something is done properly, you give your troops all the credit because, quite frankly, they're the ones that do all the work. If something gets screwed up, I'm responsible. But be honest with you, and I've told people this, and it's a truism. Now, some sheriffs you might talk to will maybe tell you how hard they work. I've got the easiest job in the office. Maybe not the easiest from mental or stress is a concern, but I don't even consider myself to be too stressed out because I have excellent people working for me. But as far as the grunt work, I don't do much of that. That's all done by the troops, and they do a yeoman's job, and they make my job quite easy, and therefore there isn't a whole lot for me to do in the way of heavy lifting, so to speak.
It sounds to me like couple of those ideas you might have picked up in the U.S. Marines, right?
Well, absolutely. You know, it sort of works that same way in the military, although law enforcement or sheriff's offices is not a military operation. It certainly is a paramilitary operation. There's a rank structure, chain of command, and quite frankly, you probably kidded around about it when you were in the Marines. The officers think of all the work to do, and the troops do it. And that's sort of the way it works, I guess, in the sheriff's office. I'm the planner and the I tell the troops what direction I want the ship taken in, and the crew gets us there, and I'm more or less standing at the helm and overseeing things, and if there's a major problem there, I'm certainly there to help out. But other than that, that's pretty much the role of a sheriff, at least in an office our size. Now, you will find if you talk to sheriffs from smaller offices, much smaller offices than ours, you'll hear the term used frequently, working sheriff. And those sheriffs are actually out writing traffic tickets, responding to accidents, going to domestic violence calls, answering radio runs for alarm drops. I mean, they do it all just alongside your troops because the county is so small, they don't have a staff that can handle all the calls for service. And ergo, the sheriff is basically another deputy insofar as the job performance is concerned.
You know, you probably remember some of the history of this, but I think I recall somebody saying that at one time here, not too long ago, in Ohio, there was a county or two where the sheriff was the only full-time person. Could that be?
Keith, yes. Basically what happened not so distant past is county governments and local governments are faced with very, very serious fiscal shortages. Whoever said the economy was taking off, of course, now we're seeing it's not taking off, even in the private sector, as many people were touting. But in the governmental operations, the demand for services and the expenses in most places are far exceeding the resources. And actually, in one county, the sheriff had to lay off his entire contingent of deputies. I think he and only maybe one other one were left for the entire county. And it was all a matter of finances. It wasn't that he wasted his money. There just wasn't enough money to go around. The sad thing about it was that the next election, the citizens were so frustrated with it all, they voted him out of office and got a new sheriff. And unfortunately, he lost his job over the whole thing, which really was unfortunate because it wasn't a problem of his own making, but one that he was, had to deal with. And quite frankly, either money doesn't grow on trees, so there wasn't much he could do about it.
Well, Sheriff, what are some of the things here over your tenure or the last several years or whatever, some of the achievements of your organization and its personnel that you're most proud of?
Well, now, I would need about 5 programs for that, Keith, but I'll try to rattle off a few. I mean, we have expanded, obviously, the jail. We have a larger jail than we did back when, and that's going to constantly be the case. We have consistently achieved 100% marks in our jail inspection. The state jail inspectors come in out of Columbus once a year, and we're almost at 100% compliance all the time. If there's any problems or minor things that just need to be tweaked, usually in some paperwork or policy, but nothing significant. We have served the courts very well. The judges are constantly praising us, and if they're not praising us, they're not complaining, and believe me, having been an attorney for 15 years, if judges see something going on that they don't like, they'll let you know. And I don't believe in 12 years I've received 3 complaints from any of the judges. On our criminal operations side, we've revamped and reactivated our traffic unit. It was virtually non-existent. The sheriff's office did not have a traffic, enforcement unit. When I came into office, we created that. We also have an underwater search and rescue team, a dive team that we have expanded greatly. We have a good presence in the schools where our DARE officer serves basically, almost 2,000 students a year in about 12 schools. We've put a motorcycle patrol on. We've added canines. And the main thing, though, Keith, beyond all those things you can look at on paper, is we get so many comments from our citizens about how professional and cordial and responsive our deputies are. I can be honest with you about this. Even though we probably have 80 to 90 deputies total in various capacities, I don't get one citizen complaint, I don't believe, every 6 months of anything significant. The most type of complaints we get are, well, I was put on hold and then I was cut off the line, which certainly can happen. But there's nothing of any of a scandalous, if you will, or unethical behavior on the part of our deputies that creates any problems, and I really thank them for that because, again, that makes us all look good, and that's perhaps the best part of this job, working with fine professionals that I do, both in the jail, corrections officers, and the deputies.
And the job that you have puts you literally, as you've mentioned before, literally puts you in touch with the executives and the heads of so many different kinds of organizations, right?
Well, yes, and that can be frustrating at times because, again, mainly because of finances, Keith. The problem we have mainly, if someone would ask me what the main problem is in our office, is trying to get more money out of the county commissioners. And I don't fault them for not giving us more because, quite frankly, every county office that I know of here in Claremont County and in most counties is strapped for money. I don't know of one sheriff's office in Ohio out of the 88 counties that exist that the sheriffs would truthfully tell you that we got more money than we need. We got more resources than we need. In many, many counties, it's not that way. In fact, just as a quick example, in one county, a sheriff I talked to, and it was just a few years ago, they couldn't even afford a copying machine for his office. So what he had to do is walk across the street every time he needed a copy, and I guess there was a Kinko's or a 5- and 10-cent store or whatever it was. They had a copying machine in there. You put a dime in. And you got your copy, so he had to keep a pocket full of dimes so he could copy reports and what have you to get his job done, the sheriff, because he did not have the budget to buy a copying machine for his office.
Wow, something else. I thought that we spent a few minutes here on the whole idea of since it's unique to your office, how do you run for office? I mean, what do you do to gear up for that?
Well, Keith, sure. Again, I would tell this to anybody looking to aspire to the office of sheriff, at least in Ohio. You really have to be prepared when the opportunity comes up because the office doesn't necessarily turn over that much. I succeeded a man who had been in here 25 years. And to be honest with you, like everything else with incumbency, maybe even more so than at the presidential level, those guys are sitting ducks. But if you're an incumbent sheriff and you're basically doing a good job and you've avoided any major problems, you're going to be extremely difficult to beat. So anyone who wants to try to knock out an incumbent had better come up with something pretty significant, not just, well, I want to be sheriff and I think I could do a better job. So you have to lay the groundwork early, but the thing I did is when Kathy and I moved out here to Claremont County, it was in the late 80s, we got involved in the community, not politically necessarily, but we did, certainly that was part of it, but got involved in some church activities, athletic activities. We got to know our neighbors. We went to a lot of community events. We attended fundraisers for other candidates. We weren't even thinking necessarily about running for office, or I wasn't at the time, but that's basically what you have to do. And even with all that, if the person in the office is about your age and they're going to be around for 20 or 30 years, it's going to be very hard, if not impossible, for you to ever get that office in that particular county. You may have to look to another office or go elsewhere. I think another thing that's important is you have to be objective about it. Everyone thinks, well, I could do a better job as sheriff. I know I could, and therefore I'm going to run, and I'm going to tell everybody that, and I'm going to get elected. It takes a lot more than that, and I think what some people do is they listen to their heart, not their mind, when they're going to seek an office, a political office, not just that of sheriff, and they listen to their friends and families who are going to tell them not necessarily what they need to hear, but what's nice to hear. And then when the reality sets in and they've faced an electoral process, they usually get stomped in the outcome, and it's all over for them. And I'll be honest with you, you spend a lot of money, time, and effort. When I first ran for sheriff, and this was in 1996, I probably put, I'm going to guess, maybe $20,000, $30,000 of my own money into the race. Not to mention all the people that I got involved and had to work for me, and I had such a great deal of support that was so gratifying, but it still involves a lot of money, and basically what you're doing is you're gambling. You're gambling with thousands of dollars on a job that, quite frankly, it's very dubious if you're going to get that job, and if you lose, and there's always a loser in a campaign, you're the odd man out, and you've got nothing to show for it, and now you're in the hole financially, so it's certainly not something for the faint-hearted, and it does require a lot of thinking, planning, realistic logic, and the final thing, though, is absolutely it's something you can't control, being at the right place at the right time and being ready to move when the opportunity presents itself.
The other thing, once you're the incumbent and you're running for re-election, just based on the uniqueness of the sheriff's office and all that, I mean, your name is out there constantly, isn't it? So that makes it difficult for somebody to overcome that in terms of name recognition, I suppose, right?
Well, absolutely, Keith. And one thing that I did as sheriff, or I have done for 12 years, and it wasn't for political reasons, although some people might think it was, but it certainly has that benefit. I'm not going to deny that. I have made myself directly accessible to all the media. They have my home phone number. They have my cell phone number. And many of them told me I'm the only chief law enforcement officer in the area that has given them that type of access to that extent. And so what will happen is if something happens in our county, they're first to call me, and, of course, when they do, I talk to them, and there's my name in print or on the screen, if you will. And because of that, my name has gotten around through some of the, I guess you might say, the national media, and I've been on MSNBC and Fox News as well, because they've called me from New York and Washington saying, we hear you're a chief law enforcement officer or a sheriff that's accessible. We have this issue we'd like to discuss with you. What do you think? And it's worked out very, very well for me, yes, because as the office of sheriff and things we do, the sheer nature of the work as opposed to maybe being a county recorder, if you will, or the treasurer auditor, there's something happening basically every day that is newsworthy, or certainly every week, and the media likes to cover those things. So you do have, I guess, what you might say, a built-in free campaign platform, if you will, although it's not certainly presented as such through the media.
My own personal definition of politics is the accumulation and application of forces to accomplish your ends, your goals, and certainly having a media presence is one of those. I mean, you have to think about it.
And, well, absolutely. And
yeah,
be honest with you. Go ahead.
Just on a side note, I was wondering, what's it like for the First Lady of the Sheriff's Office? Any special duties there?
No, but she has made it clear more than once, Keith, that when I walk through the door, my power in this particular abode ends. I do not have any legal or statutory or command authority over her home, so to speak. We are on equal footing, or if anything, she's got me trumped in that area, and we get along very, very well. And I don't bring my work home with me too much, although there's some things that happen I tell her about. It sort of stops when I come in the door, and it works out quite well that way, unless I get called in the middle of the night, which, quite frankly, doesn't happen a whole lot, because I've got a chief deputy who handles probably 90% of that, and he does it very, very well. He's an excellent man, and he's served me well as my other chief deputy in the jail. I probably don't know what's going on in the office maybe as much as I should, but nothing has happened horrendously, and they divert a lot of problems before they even get to my level, and I guess that's the way it should work.
What are the interactions with the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association and the NSA, the National Sheriff's Association? What are they doing? What's on their minds nowadays relative to your job?
Well, Keith, I'd say in a nutshell, to sum things up with them, I think their main priority or the concern of sheriff's associations nationally is the preservation and protection of the office of sheriff. In some states, not Ohio, thank God, but there are some states, and I think Connecticut may have been one, and there's some around the country that basically, because, again, of limited resources and ability to fund things, have talked about merging or eliminating the Office of Sheriff and folding them into other agencies and basically putting the sheriffs in those particular jurisdictions out of business. And sheriff's associations and, of course, sheriffs themselves are very sensitive and concerned about that. And I would say, you know, that's one of the, if not the only priority. Obviously, training and professionalism is high up there, too. But there's always that concern that some legislation or idea is going to come along to compromise our positions in our office.
I don't know what the history was in Oregon, but you and I were commenting about this. I think Oregon appoints sheriffs, don't they?
You know, Keith, I'm not sure. There are some states that do that, or very, very few jurisdictions. Most of them are directly elected. There's pros and cons to that. I think a pro is that you've got a lot of people deciding who's going to be the sheriff rather than maybe three or five or six in a closed room. People say, well, because you're elected, your office is political. Well, it's certainly political to get picked as a police chief many places, too, especially if there's only two or three people doing the deciding, or if you're going to become, say, for example, you and I had a chat about becoming the dean of a university. What goes into that particular process and picking deans? It's usually decided by a few people, and there's a lot of factors that come into that that not necessarily have everything to do with necessarily the best person for the job, but who knows who's connected, and if you have a group, say, of councilmen or trustee picking a sheriff, I can't say that would be any less political or any more fair than letting the people decide. So the political process, although it's got its drawbacks, obviously, you got to be careful not to get too involved in partisan politics. I think it's worked fairly well in Ohio, and I don't see that changing here, at least.
Yeah, that's great. My answer to the people that say it's political, the office of sheriff, I'd say it's representative. You know,
that's a good way to say it. Yes, sir, I agree with you.
What's the hardest part of the job? You mind commenting on a few things about that? I mean, what?
Oh, no, not at all. Well, again, I think I mentioned earlier is getting enough resources and money to do what you think you need to do to serve the citizens properly. You know, we've had very limited growth here in Claremont County Sheriff's Office. We've had a few deputies, but really in 12 years, it's amazing how few we've added in comparison to our calls for service. In other words, the demand for our services has gone up much higher and much faster than our ability to add the right amount of people that we feel is necessary to do the job fully, completely, and professionally. I'm not saying we're not getting the job done, but it's frustrating not being able to do it at the level we would like to do because of financial considerations beyond our control. So I would have to say that's the main problem we're dealing with. The other thing that we run into is, you know, when you talk about state legislators and senators, their job is to legislate. I mean, that's what they got hired to do. Let's face it, they're in office to pass new laws, and pass new laws they do. And with many of the new laws that are passed, they become unfunded mandates. There's no funding attached to them for local offices or government entities. And we have to enforce those laws without getting the extra resources to do them, and ergo, it strains us even further. So really, in a nutshell, Keith, that's the main thing. The citizens we deal with are, by and large, I would say the vast majority of them, decent people that don't give us really any problems. They only call us when they have a critical event in their lives. And the staff I work with are excellent, and the other law enforcement agencies and the chief executives I work with, here in Claremont County at least, it's not true everywhere, unfortunately. We have a very smooth and professional and cordial working relationship. So, quite frankly, it's the best job I've ever had, and I was very fortunate, honored, and blessed to have the opportunity.
You know, in a former life, I had a chance here for about 5 years to talk to lots of chiefs and sheriffs on a fairly regular basis, and this is very unscientific, but I kind of think the sheriffs were happier.
Well, Keith, I think you're right. I know a lot of, I have known and know a lot of disgruntled police chiefs, and I don't know why it is, but it seems to me the way the system is set up and they have to report to council people and boards of supervisors and trustees, for some reason there seems to be more friction there. I think part of it is the way, again, the person is selected. There is no one in this county at the county level, insofar as officials are concerned, can do anything to demote me, mess with my salary, remove me from office, or do anything along those lines. I would have to commit a crime or high treason for any of that to happen, and then, of course, the legal system would take care of it. But short of that, I'm basically insulated from all of those, you might say, belches and jerks, knee-jerk reactions within the bureaucracy that can occur. And therefore, sheriffs can get their job done, and that's one thing they don't have to worry about. They don't have to go to work every day thinking, gosh, if I tick off, there's three trustees, let's see, if I make two of them mad, I might be looking for a job next month. So you don't have that, and I think you're right. It's although there's stress in the job, that particular aspect of the job is not there as a stressor.
You know, those police chiefs have come to work on certain days across the nation throughout history and found out that somebody decided in a back room or somewhere that they weren't going to keep them anymore. And
Well, I've heard that, and you probably know more about this than I am, but I don't know. I heard the statistic, but I couldn't recite it now, but what the average tenure of a police chief is in a moderate to a medium to small-sized organization is not very long. They do not last very long, and I can say from experience out here, I've observed in many of our departments, we have 15 in Claremont County, by the way, just about 15, there has been an exodus and influx of police chiefs in many, many of those departments during the time I was sheriff, and certainly most of them didn't last 25 years as a previous sheriff here, Sheriff Van Camp did.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Tim, we're about out of time. I can't believe it, and I thank you very much for this overview and deep insight into the position of sheriff and what you do and what your fine troops do. And, you know, praise the Lord, you got some good thing going on down there. And keep up the great work, and we'll look forward to talking to you later. Audrey's giving that signal. It's time to play the cutoff music. So thank you very much.
Keith, thank you for having me on, and anytime you want me back, feel free to give me a holler. If you have any questions, you know how to get a hold of me.
Okay, certainly do. Good night. Have a good evening. Bye.
You too, Keith. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Look on the billboard to see what we're doing next week. And again, we want to thank Sheriff Rodenberg for an outstanding evening. And I think you already know we're going to be putting his chapter in a book on police executives. We're going to do an audio book. So see us next time. And here's Vera Lynn to sign us off.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. I just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. Will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Don't know where.
Blog Talk Radio.